Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. Gabe here without Connor. He's in Greece at the moment, and I am joined in the studio right now by Matthew Ward Aegis, whom I essentially just met.
They dragged me in off the street.
I was going to say, you have joined the science department here at DW.
I have.
For 6 months?
Mm-hmm.
Did you just get to Germany, or how long have you been here?
About a month. Yeah.
And you are an Australian journalist, a serious journalist from...
Yes, I am a serious journalist. No, I've been here a month.
Yeah.
And before I came over, I'd signed the contract with DW.
Mm-hmm.
And before I jumped on the plane, I was flicking through the homepage and they wrote this great story about the infamous German bureaucracy and how there's now a museum in Berlin dedicated to sort of mocking it. And I thought, I should make sure I go as quickly as possible and settle in and make myself at home before I start. So, it's not been a long time that I've been here. Been to Germany before, but, first time living and excited to be part of the team.
Yeah, you've got your forms set. You've got an apartment, and you're coming into work here. What have you been writing?
I've been writing, it feels like, a lot about things that are happening in the ground recently.
Uh-huh.
Archaeology,
okay,
specifically, and the way in which humans have changed over the years.
Okay.
Over the many thousands of years.
Are you referring to, let me see if I can get this correct, Homo floresiensis?
Yes, correct.
The smallest known human species.
Yep, just over a meter tall, which is roughly the average height, granted around the world there is some variation, but roughly the average height of a four-year-old.
Of a four-year-old.
Yeah.
And the bones that were found of this species were on the island of Flores.
That's right.
In Indonesia. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't.
It's kind of in your neck of the woods?
I guess if you consider the southern hemisphere my neck of the woods, yes. No, I haven't been to Flores, but it is in Indonesia. It's at one of the many Indonesian islands. And about 20 years ago now was when the first skeleton of this species was found.
Mm-hmm.
It was nicknamed Hobbit Man or Flores Man. Because at the time it was discovered, Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films were sort of all the rage.
Yeah.
And this was a teensy tiny hominin, a human-like species.
Okay.
What has continued in Indonesia for the many years since is this constant search for other bones of this species.
Okay. And that's the news now.
That is the news now.
That more bones have been found that confirm what exactly? That this mini human remained mini over hundreds of thousands of years?
Yeah, it's interesting. They're not new. It's not a new finding as in we made the dig last year, dug it up, we've done the analysis, we're publishing now. It's that we're publishing now, but this is from a dig that took place about 10 years ago where more bones were discovered. But it's a reevaluation of those bones. And one of them in particular is from this particular excavation, the humerus bone, the upper arm bone.
Mm-hmm.
What they have done is measured it, analyzed it, and worked out that actually the species was even smaller about 700,000 years ago. So it was believed that these human hobbits basically died out about 20 to 50,000 years ago. There was some reanalysis, probably about 50,000 years ago, which for what it's worth means that they probably would have been living alongside Homo sapiens.
Yeah. A little bit like the Neanderthals, actually.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, so let's get the timeline, right? This species probably came from Homo erectus. It's a biped.
It's debated. It's still a debated origin story. But one of the stronger hypotheses is that Homo erectus jumped over to these islands.
And then shrunk?
Shrunk. Very quickly shrunk in a very short amount of time.
Why?
Well, when I was speaking to some of the researchers that were either involved in this study or had been involved in other analyses of the original specimen that was found 20 years ago, I asked them the same question, like shrinking? What's going on?
Yeah.
One of the arguments made is that, firstly, you're going from, say, the Asian continent to a small island.
Gigantic landmass to a place where you can't really move around very
Correct.
Much.
Can't move around.
And then you automatically shrink? Or
But don't necessarily have a lot of resources either.
Okay.
So you need to have energy. And if you don't have a lot of resources from which to gain that energy, we probably can't support such a big form. So it might be time for you to shrink down so that you have a body morphology that is more suited to the resources that you can consume.
That needs less calories. Is
Correct.
That fewer
Correct.
Calories.
And okay. then one of the other arguments, of course, is that if you're not being chased around by other predatory animals and you're on an island where there might not be many predators, you might not need to, again, have this evolutionary requirement to be able to run harder, run faster, you know, jump into trees to evade predators. So that is another possible explanation as well. And, you know, when we make these hypotheses, we look to other animal species that have done so as well. Often birds, they go to an island and they evolve different characteristics. They might reduce in size, for example, for these similar reasons.
Got it.
That's not necessarily the case here, though. It is disputed by some researchers. Some researchers that say, well, we need to get some more specimens here because what we've got is a specimen, a fairly complete skeleton that's about 50,000 years old. And then we've got some bone fragments, a humerus bone, as I mentioned, and some teeth and a jawbone that are 700,000 years old. So that's a massive time gap between
I was gonna say,
the examples.
In that 700,000 years or however long it was, what else do we know?
Not much.
About the Flores hobbits?
Not a lot.
Okay.
What we basically have is some very high quality samples, some specimens that we can actually analyze. What we are able to do, and by way, of course, I mean the research is here, but take that skeleton, that first complete skeleton, or fairly complete skeleton that was obtained, and then match it up to these more recent excavations that are of older specimens and say, well, we've got a humerus that we know is 50,000 years old. Let's compare it to this humerus that we know is 700,000 years old. It's slightly smaller. And when we extrapolate that, scale it up, we think that there's probably about, 10 centimetres that disappears here for the final form of this species. So that's about the extent of what we know. And of course, what we would love to have is, with many examples of archaeology of this nature, more specimens to study and actually sort of fill the gaps in.
Yeah. You were also writing about Mars?
Yeah, this is a fun one.
Okay. It has to do with water. I mean, I only saw a headline here.
So
water was found in Mars, but not on the surface?
Not on the surface.
Deep underneath the surface?
11 kilometers beneath the surface.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
and the big news here is that, what, we could extract this water or or that it could sustain life? Or
Well, I think it's probably...
Why is this important? Because everyone is talking about this.
Probably the latter. I think it's one of those things, this fascinating stories. We know that Mars, if we're going to inhabit any other planet in our solar system, it's probably going to be Mars. Mercury's way too hot. Venus will get burnt by sulfuric acid or gas by sulfur in the atmosphere. Mars, pretty dry, cold, looks uninhabitable planet. But hey, we know there's polar ice caps. And where there's polar ice caps, that means water. And where there's water, that might mean life. What has been found by an American study analyzing old data from the NASA InSight lander, which isn't operating anymore. But from the data, they thought, let's take a look at some seismic information that this lander was able to obtain prior to 4 years ago when it sort of started to wrap up its work. And let's see if we can take what we know about gravity and the sort of speed of sound through different material to try and work out the composition of the crust of Mars.
That is an incredible...
And what it might actually be.
That's an incredible analysis. Based on waves, you can see the chemical makeup of something?
That's right, sound waves. And so using this information from Mars quakes and tremors, they've been able to sort of say, hey, actually, we think that that's water. We think that's liquid water underneath the surface of Mars. The caveats are, they've worked out that It's 11 kilometers beneath the surface. We can't even use our technology on our planet on to Earth. Drill 1 kilometer beneath
the surface.
I was
going to say, there was news this week about drilling a mile into the mantle.
Mm.
That's not even it's close not, well, to us. Okay.
We've put some things onto the surface of Mars, Gabe. We we haven't put a massive science fiction drill onto Mars yet to be able to get down there.
So we're not going to touch this water anytime soon. Why are we talking about this right now?
Because it goes back to that question of life.
Mm-hmm.
If we assume that water is essential to life as we know it, then maybe that's where life is on Mars.
Was or could be.
Was or could be, potentially.
So this water
or
could have at some point been on the surface?
Yeah, and so this is again, another interesting thing.
Down,
this is the thing that really interested me about it, because when the billions of years ago, when the atmosphere of Mars disappears, you're exposing the planet to all of that solar radiation, which we know is going to vaporize the water.
Yeah. It's going to blast everything and then make the water disappear.
See you later.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you're left with this, without wanting to be offensive to the red planet, fairly dry, desolate environment.
Yeah. Bit of dust.
Bit of dust. And cold enough still at the poles to have frozen water. The hypothesis here is that actually the water went effectively down and formed an aquifer, no different to groundwater on our planet. And that, again, if life is going to be found, it might well be infused in the rock of Mars's crust and mantle, and that's where it might be.
When I read about this, I was wondering just quickly, why doesn't this happen on Earth? We've got all this water that's so heavy on the surface of our Earth. Why doesn't it leak in through holes?
I guess it does, though, doesn't it? Because we have groundwater. We have these massive aquifers underneath our surface.
Okay, so there is something similar underneath our oceans. Then there is water down in
that's
the rock.
That's right. I mean, well, we're standing on land right now, and we know that if we go down far enough, we're going to get water somehow, aren't we? So
dig a well. Yeah,
that's it. The thing is, we don't have to go too far to get to it.
About
on
8 meters where we're from.
Correct. We're probably going to have to go quite a way on the red planet. The interesting thing, I think, for the research team that led this is that, and this was from the University of California, that the guys that were doing this are sort of oceanographers. You know, they're not necessarily looking at space for their normal research. What they think is particularly interesting, though, is this is what a water cycle on a planet that has never been affected by humans, for the most part, could look like in its long geological history. So there's, to be very casual about it, plenty of chicken left on the bone when it comes to analysing how water and Mars have interacted across billions of years, and then potentially where we might find life, or indeed how we might use water, or how water might behave if we were trying to colonise it, which is, of course, on the agenda for space agencies like NASA.
All right. Well, that, for the people listening right now, is what is behind some of the news stories that DW is churning out these days. Thank you to Matthew Ward Aegis. Thank you for coming in and essentially replacing Connor for this week. You did a wonderful job.
Australian accent just making a cameo appearance.
If you guys want to read his work, we've got Ancient Hobbits Even Smaller Than Originally Thought, the first topic that we discussed, and the Mars story is Liquid Ocean Discovered Beneath Mars Surface. Check his content out and let us know what you guys think, or if you have any observations or anything to say at all, let us know. Thank you, Matthew Ward Aegis, for coming in.
Thanks, Guy.
That was phenomenal.
It's like being back on
When it comes to health issues affecting women, some of the most common conditions are found in the pelvic floor. One in four women will encounter a pelvic floor condition during the course of life, be it a urinary tract infection, overactive bladder, incontinence, or pelvic organ prolapse. It's quite probable, in other words, that you or someone you know will have to deal with one of these afflictions, or perhaps you are right now. Of course, the best way to get information about how to treat pelvic floor conditions is from a medical professional. But the way the world works these days, of course, is that you will probably first go online. However, what you find there, and in particular, the videos that maybe are the most popular, don't always contain the best information. One of Yale's leading urology experts, Dr. Leslie Rickey, and a team of researchers at the Yale School of Medicine went through a slew of videos on TikTok and arrived at that very conclusion.
Science Unscripted.
Okay, so my name is Leslie Rickey. I'm an associate professor at the Yale School of Medicine, specializing in neurogynecology, and that's in New Haven, Connecticut. And the study we did was the information available on TikTok related to female pelvic floor conditions.
And what did you find out about the way people are getting information on TikTok about pelvic floor conditions?
So we found out that the TikTok videos that are that have the highest user engagement with the most likes and shares and comments actually add overall poor medical quality information and also high rates of misinformation.
Can you give me an example right from the start of the misinformation that people are getting on TikTok when it comes to pelvic floor conditions?
Well, I would say that overall, the information isn't necessarily dangerous, but some of it can just be misleading, and it might lead people down the wrong path and delay their access to getting appropriate care. So, for example, some information on how to treat urinary tract infections, not that it might be dangerous, but it might not be evidence-based or helpful. Therefore, people might continue to have their urinary tract infections for longer and delay seeking medical care.
What were the pelvic floor conditions that you were looking at in the study?
So pelvic floor conditions are conditions that can affect female pelvic organs and the muscles and ligaments that support those organs. So the condition, so these can affect the bladder, the vagina, and the bowels. What we were primarily looking at was urinary incontinence, overactive bladder, pelvic organ prolapse, and urinary tract infections in women.
And what kind of women are normally affected by these conditions?
So that's a great question. It's actually considered to be something that affects older women, but in fact, 25% of all women 18 years and older can have some sort of pelvic floor condition, although the conditions do tend to increase in frequency and severity as women age.
And the videos that you were looking at on TikTok, were they what were they like? Were they saying wrong things about these conditions, or did they have tips that were wrong, or what was the problem with them?
Yeah, and I do want to emphasize that not all of the videos contained misinformation or poor quality information. This is just the average scores that we saw. And one of the things that's interesting about TikTok is that you can have a range of publishers. So you could have people like women and girls sharing their stories. You could have different types of medical providers sharing information. And I think all of that information is potentially helpful, but again, there was not a lot of what I would call evidence-based medical information that was posted by like physicians, for example, that specialize in female pelvic floor conditions or urogynecology.
Is there a lack of information in the general public when it comes to these conditions, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the primary problems. I'm actually involved also in a research group that looks at prevention of urinary tract symptoms in women called the PLUS Consortium. And we did some focus groups and found that overall women were quite frustrated by the lack of information, especially around bladder conditions. And so as you can imagine, when you're not getting that information from public health sources or your provider, you're going to turn to online, as many of us do, you know, the quote unquote Dr. Google. And so women learn about these things from having these experiences themselves, from watching those around them, and then, you know, as we're finding out, going on social media to fill in the gaps.
And what are your tips for those women who are looking for information on these conditions right now?
So I do think that social media platforms are a really powerful way to disseminate information, educate women, empower them to get care. I just think you want to look at the source and maybe do a little research. And I'm grateful for social media for highlighting the way that that women experience these symptoms. But I guess I would really want women to seek out their healthcare provider and push a little bit, you know, describe their condition and ask for a referral if they want more information on it instead of only relying on the online information.
What is the reason for this lack of information when it comes to pelvic floor conditions for women?
I think there's a number of reasons. I think one, that many of these conditions, such as urinary tract infections, urinary incontinence, pelvic organ prolapse, are seen merely as quality of life conditions. I think also a lot of women just accept some of these conditions as something that is a normal part of aging, especially bladder issues. And we like to say, just because they're common doesn't make it normal. There is some stigma around these conditions, so women don't speak up. And it's also been shown that doctors don't ask. So I think all of these things have led to women just managing these issues in private and it not making it to the public health sector. But hopefully that will be changing, you know, with some of the research that we're doing in terms of prevention work and also how to get this information out into the public more effectively. Because there's a lot known about pelvic floor disorders in women. It's just that it's housed in the scientific community. And we need better ways to get it out to the people that it affects, which are girls and women across their lifespan.
Any last tips for any women listening to this broadcast right now, when it comes to getting help that they need and they maybe are too afraid to ask for?
So I think we need to reframe these conditions as important medical conditions and not just quality of life. So just like you would ask your doctor if you were concerned about high blood pressure or diabetes, about your weight, if you're having problems with pelvic floor disorders, especially incontinence and overactive bladder, urinary tract infections that are affecting your ability to do what you want to do in life, and you're not doing some of the travel or social or physical activities that you'd like to, that's important. And so talk to your doctor about it. And if you don't get the answers that you need, then seek out a specialist, because there are specialists that provide care specifically for these pelvic floor disorders in women.
Dr. Leslie Rickey, speaking to us there from the Yale School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut. The study is found in the journal Neurourology and Urodynamics with the title TikTok Misinformation and User Engagement in Female Pelvic Floor. And it was led by one of Dr. Rickey's students at the Yale School of Medicine, Alicia Steffen. If you have any questions about the study or about some of the pelvic floor conditions we discussed here, please let us know. I'll do my best to get those answered. And now I believe we have a couple minutes left on this show. And I just returned from Norway. Had the vacation of my life. I have Norwegian roots, and I spent 3 weeks with my family on the west coast of Norway in the fjords, and Edvard Grieg happens to be the voice of the fjords, one of the most respected, well-known Norwegian composers of music, and we happened to park at a parking garage in Bergen. It was the Edvard Grieg garage, and I was thinking to myself, when I get back, I have to play some Edvard Grieg if I get a chance, and it just so happens that I have a couple minutes here to play some Edvard Grieg. So here it is, the slow movement of his A minor piano concerto. He wrote this piece of music when he was 24 years old. It is the voice of the fjords. Enjoy.
Science Unscripted.
Thank you. DW, made for minds.